Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Neil Garfield Show, a presentation sponsored by www.livinglies.wordpress.com, GTC Honored, and the law firm of Garfield, Kelly & White, serving all 50 states with news and analysis of the latest bank scams against borrowers, homeowners, consumers, and investors, and providing legal representation throughout Florida. This program is for general information only. It is not a solicitation for services or legal representation and should never be used as a substitute for advice from a licensed professional. And now, here's world-renowned financial expert, attorney, and blogger, Neil Garfield.
And hello, this is Neil Garfield, and this is Thursday, January 22nd, 2015. I can't believe we're already in 2015. And a hearty welcome to all the bank lawyers listening in to see what I'm going to say or do next. The stage is set now for our long-awaited launch of AMGAR. Recent decisions in the courts have made the program real instead of hypothetical. And investors are calling me from all points on the globe. Not long ago, I kept getting the same question. People would say to me, okay, Neil, we understand what you say actually happened, but how do we prove that? My answer was, and it remains, that you should not be required to prove it, that the burden is on the other side to prove that they actually had transactions in which they loaned money and purchased the loans. That didn't happen, and the banks have relied upon fabricated and legal presumptions to avoid opening their books to reveal that there is nothing behind that fabricated paper. I was just using basic law applied to basic legal procedure. You make a claim, you need to prove it. But judges and lawyers got confused by the difference between what is required for pleading a case and what is required for proving it. And that is where trial courts at the trial level and appellate courts have been kneecapping the banks for their misbehavior, their fraudulent documents, their fabricated instruments, forgery and robo-signing, backdating, and so forth, because it is now understood that none of the paper would be necessary if none of that paper would be necessary if the paper was real. And the proof of the reality of the paper lies in whether there was an actual transaction where one person pays money and the other gets the money and gives up something valuable in return, which is received by the person who paid the money. If that didn't happen, then the paper is worthless. And finally, this week, the 4th District Court of Appeal in Florida tackled those questions surrounding these ghostly papers worthy of a Charles Dickens novel like Bleak House, if any of you have read it, where he described lawyers arguing motions on a case they have long since forgotten the issues. The 4th DCA held clearly and convincingly, after analyzing the UCC and the parties and the claim transactions, and arrived at the conclusion that there are no presumptions available where the transactions did not take place. It held, and I quote, that the banks, quote, cannot rely on possession of the instrument alone as a basis to enforce it. The transferee does not enjoy the statutorily provided assumption of the right to enforce the instrument that accompanies a negotiated instrument. And so the transferee must account for possession of, in this case, an unendorsed instrument by proving the transaction through which the transferee acquired it. Note that this does not apply to all cases. There are frequently cases where there are endorsed instruments, but similar holdings would apply given the right circumstances and the right presentation. If there, and I go on quoting, if there are multiple prior transfers, the transferee must prove each prior transfer. Once the transferee establishes a successful transfer from a holder, he or she acquires the enforcement rights of that holder. A transferee's rights, however, can be no greater than his or her transferor's, because those rights are purely derivative. That's the words that the court used, and I think they were taking a shot at the banks, saying we know what derivative means, and we think that what you're doing is using derivatives as a smokescreen. And then it goes on to say that HSBC had to prove the chain of transfer starting with option one, California, as the first holder of the note. The only document admitted at trial that purported to transfer the note was the PSA, which is the pooling and servicing agreement. And the court goes on, although the note was included in the PSA, the parties to the PSA were ACE, Option One Mortgage Corporation, Wells Fargo, and HSBC, not Option One California. So my comment on that is the shell game of names will now start working against the banks instead of against the homeowner. Although I will tell you that I just had one case today where the fact that the names didn't match up was considered not only irrelevant, but should not be allowed to even bring it up. There are judges who are still ruling that way. And the court went on to say the loan analyst testified that Option One California was acquired by AHMS, which rebranded to Homeward Residential, which was ultimately acquired by Ocwen. HSBC argues that since Option 1 is defined under the PSA as Option 1 Mortgage Corporation or any successor thereto, and Option 1 transferred its assets to HSBC through the PSA, HSBC had the rights of a holder. We disagree. That's the quote from the Fourth District Court of Appeal. And I think that this case is going to be mirrored in dozens of decisions that we're going to see in Florida and around the country. The Supreme Court of the United States, whose decision is final, says unanimously that rescission allowed under the Truth in Lending Act means what it says. There is no mortgage if you did it within the time period required under TILA, and that means there are thousands of people who still own property they thought was foreclosed years ago. The mortgage was nullified when the notice of rescission was sent, and the so-called lenders involved owe you a satisfaction of mortgage, a canceled note, and they owe you every penny you paid at closing for points, fees, and anything else, and they owe you every penny you ever paid them in principal and interest on the mortgage. And there may be treble damages available too. The fourth DCA in Florida, in the decision yesterday, said that in many cases the banks do need to prove the underlying transactions and not just rely on the presumptions attendant to what appears to be facially valid paper. The cases are pouring in from around the country as courts grow increasingly skeptical about this process called securitization. I think that's why they use the word derivative in their opinion. They are beginning to realize that the paper is just that, paper, and not really worth what is written on it, and in fact less because it is used paper. It has been 7 years since I told everyone who would listen that the rescission remedy in the Truth in Lending Act was different from the rescission remedy in common law. I said then, and I say now, that it is a remedial statute designed to give borrowers some strength in fighting with misbehaving banks. And that's what the Supreme Court affirmed, and their decision is final. But most courts, before the Supreme Court decision, refused to enforce those rights until the unanimous decision of a Supreme Court that was thought to be deeply divided along partisan lines. And Justice Scalia, the fundamentalist on the court, wrote the opinion. Rescission means that the mortgage is gone by operation of law. There are restrictions, but the remedy is there, and those who abandon their case for rescission now should know that they never had to bring a case for rescission, and that their rescission by letter was final. There was no mortgage after that, and there could be no valid foreclosure. So many people, I am told, are gearing up to go back in time and get their property back. And many of those cases are going to involve wrongful foreclosure claims with compensatory and punitive damages, attorney's fees, costs, and disgorgement of all money paid at closing and disgorgement of all monthly payments of principal and interest. The Federal Truth in Lending Act has, from the time it was enacted, been the sole protection to consumers of increasingly sophisticated financial products. Then came an army of lawyers paid by Wall Street, and with briefs stacked to the ceiling and assumptions on the part of judges that no bank with a big brand name would engage in the kind of misbehavior where there was a systemic pattern of fraud. And suddenly, TILA protection started to melt away until this Supreme Court decision. 8 years ago, I said there was no real transaction at closing, no matter how silly that looked or sounded. I said that I knew that because I had sources, but it also was the only answer that made sense. None of the so-called assignments, endorsements, or transfer of the loan papers were connected with any actual purchase and sale agreement. There was no transfer of money. Who would allow someone else to take control of paper that was worth $300,000 without paying for it? Nobody, unless the paper was not worth $300,000 because the holder never paid for it. The UCC in Article 9 says that in order to enforce the mortgage, you need to pay value for it. The courts and lawyers have been inexplicably confused, not recalling basic premises of their law school classes dealing with contracts and commercial paper. And now the fourth DCA in Florida says that those presumptions based upon facial validity of the paper are in many cases not enough to enforce. There is no underlying transaction. The paper is mere fabrication. I caution you again that what I am saying here is my opinion and my reading of that case and many other cases. This is not a substitute for legal advice on your case. You should consult with legal counsel who is licensed in the jurisdiction in which your property is located. If that attorney says something different, then that's what you should be going by. Homeowners are starting to win, and I'll give you some info on that and take a few questions in a moment. Those legal presumptions used in foreclosure cases are rebuttable, but you must do it right or you won't be able to do it at all. And some of those legal presumptions, like in the fourth DCA opinion, don't even exist. The law keeps evolving. The courts are showing in unsteady steps, but leading increasingly to the inevitable showdown where the debts, the notes, the mortgages, the alleged sales of mortgages are or mostly shown to be a huge fraudulent scheme. But at the same time as we are winning, and sometimes winning big in courts, other judges are sticking to the idea that they don't want to be part of some strategy that allows the homeowner to go scot-free. And no matter how hard I try with these judges, and this is the experience of many lawyers around the country, No matter how creative we are in presentation, many judges choose to hear an argument we are not making. The very idea that the judge siding with misbehaving banks is gifting a house and a ton of money that is never revealed in court is something that judges can't get their minds around, and many lawyers. And so we fight on, getting more and more judges to realize that the end of this charade is near. But the other side of the coin is also true. I had a judge determine that there were no real defenses to a foreclosure as long as somebody said they're the holder. As long as the borrower received the loan and stopped paying. It doesn't matter to those judges whether the loan is owed to someone else, and it doesn't matter that the loans were part of a fraudulent scheme. I'm broadcasting live from Boynton Beach, Florida, brought to you by the Living Lies blog, GTC Honors, AMGAR, the Garfield firm with offices in South Florida. And this show is specially brought to you because of donations to the Living Lies blog from listeners like you. Thank you. And a special thanks to all the lawyers reaching out to me from across the country, sharing ideas, pleadings, and strategy. Tide has turned. Lawyers are picking up the torch and running with it, and I'm proud to be a member of the legal profession. And that pride does extend to hardworking judges who are trying to master the most complicated fraudulent scheme that Wall Street has come up with so far. For those of you who are not contributors to the blog, we ask that you call 954-495-9867 and pledge whatever you think you can afford. Even $5 per month will make a difference for thousands, perhaps hundreds of thousands of people. A little goes a long way. Call 954-495-9867 or 520-405-1688 and pledge whatever you think you can. If you get voicemail, please leave a message. Our mission here is to share as much information as we can to help beleaguered homeowners and other people who may not be aware of the effect the housing crisis has had. If you have lost a job or being paid less or you're losing benefits, it is most likely caused, at least in part, by the misbehaving banks who suck the life out of our economy. We have concentrated almost exclusively here on mortgage loans, but soon we'll be turning our attention and our fire to student loans, credit card debts, auto loans, and other consumer loans that have been subjected to false claims of securitization. If you are a homeowner who signed documents without realizing you are not getting the money from the party named on the note, the mortgage, and the settlement documents, you may not owe any money on the note, but you may still have a debt that is unsecured, and the mortgage that was recorded probably void or subject to nullification by a court, which means quiet title is possible despite decisions and comments to the contrary over the last few years. If you are a homeowner who was lured into a deal that couldn't work based upon blatant lies told to you by people who knew better and who knew you would believe them, then you're in the right place here. Then, of course, is the big lie that you have to be 90 days behind to be considered for loan modification. That is the bank's way of saying, screw you. Stop paying, we will promise a modification, and then we'll forget about that and we'll foreclose on you. That particular one is backfiring with increasing regularity against the banks all across the country. So we start with the basics. You start with a loan contract. Who made the offer? Who accepted it? What were the terms, and was the loan completed by the parties to the contract? Most importantly, was there consideration? Consideration means, did you pay for it? More and more judges are seeing that the basics are where the banks failed. They used other people's money without protecting those other people. And blind justice doesn't care which side sees a greater decision. Blind justice requires that the law be applied evenly, fairly, and with due process. And if everyone actually behaved according to basic law, we wouldn't need the Truth in Lending Act or any of these fights in court. We have several questions here, and I will try to get to them now. Starting with, having trouble with my switchboard. Okay, starting with area code 920, first three digits 219. What is your question?
What is the statute of limitations for a right to rescind if the transaction was never consummated? And then how do you rescind that transaction if it never occurred?
That is really a very good question. Okay, let's start off with the basics. The basics are that the statute of limitations is 3 years from the date of consummation of the transaction, and the usual presumed date of transaction, of consummation of the transaction, is the day that you signed the documents. But
right, we have the wire confirmation statement.
Excuse me.
We have a wire confirmation. We have a wire confirmation that proves it was table funded.
Okay. Well, that's good. Now, the time at which the disclosures were made, the way they were supposed to be made, assuming they were material disclosures, are, according to many courts, but this is not completely decided, the starting point for the 3 years. And I just saw a case today where a loan which started in 2003, the facts didn't come out until 2012, and it was and is my opinion that they should retain an attorney, but they should send a notice of rescission. And the statute does not require you to give your reasons. The more reasons you give, the easier it is for them to pick it apart. So the less you say, the better, but make sure that you refer to the loan number. I'm suggesting that you attach the note and the mortgage. If there was a modification, that might affect the time when the statute starts running. There are a number of potential times when that occurs. Moving on to our next question, area code 239, first three digits 434. What is your question?
Oh, hello, Mr. Garfield. On that latest statute of limitations case with, is it Beauvais, I guess, with Deutsch?
Right.
I had a case here in Florida that was an 08 case, and in 2012 it was involuntarily dismissed at the end of 2012. So my statute of limitations should be up. However, a few months into the case, I filed a forbearance agreement for 6 months, and I maintained those payments that were agreed upon, which was, you know, about $500 less than my normal payment. Did that negate my acceleration commencement of the 5-year statute of limitation? Because in that case, it says because the installment nature of the loan payment was never reinstated following the acceleration, there were no new payments due,
right.
So there was no default.
Right. I understand. So you're asking about the statute of limitations relating to acceleration, not rescission, correct?
Yes, to excel. I'm sorry. I shouldn't be asking that because you're in a rescission program.
No, no.
I don't know.
The question is fine. I just wanted to make sure that I understood what it was.
Acceleration.
Okay. So
did I?
There are, unfortunately, in the law, there's multiple answers to your questions.
Okay.
From what you have described, it is certainly possible for the bank to argue that the statute of limitations was told during the time of forbearance. On the other hand, the argument for the homeowner would probably be that it wasn't really forbearance, it was a modification, which in effect changed the terms of the loan, and if at that time the real facts were disclosed to the homeowner, than the statute was not told as to the acceleration, and the statute first started at the time of the modification or settlement. But I have to warn you that the courts are all over the lot on this. And like I just reported, I've run into judges who simply apply the law, and that basically kneecaps the banks. But there are a lot of judges still out there who just don't like the idea of giving the homeowner what they think is a free ride. And so they will find reasons to rule in favor of the foreclosing party and against the borrower. But the good news is that in an increasing number of cases, the appellate courts are reversing trial courts that do that. So we'll go to the next question here and see if I can do that. We've got 2 minutes and 40 seconds. That would be area code 916, first three digits, 542.
Neil Garfield, it's Jim Macklin in lovely Lake Tahoe.
Jim Macklin?
How are you, buddy?
Ladies and gentlemen, Jim Macklin is one of our best forensic analysts, very creative, and a real thinker. In terms of developing the forensic analysis of mortgage loans,
and one who just filed a Rule 60B motion in U.S. District and in bankruptcy adversary to vacate all orders that are in conflict with the Jezinoski decision.
Okay, let's say that in English. What Jim is saying is that he's reopening a bankruptcy because the bankruptcy court specifically held that he had to, A, bring a lawsuit to effect rescission, that the letter wasn't enough, and that since he didn't bring the lawsuit within the 3 years, he couldn't do so, and B, he was supposed to tender the money and really have the money, both of which were knocked out by the unanimous Supreme Court decision that I referred to before. Since you just filed it today, I assume that you don't have any rulings back from the court. Sometimes federal judges rule very quickly electronically.
We had parallel cases in the district court as well as the bankruptcy adversary, and we don't expect anything to move for probably 2 weeks. Eastern District is backed up. I called in because of the subject matter I saw on the email that I got, and I wanted to ask you if you mind if I give you a very specific citation from SCOTUS related to the tolling of the TILA statute. I've got it in front of me, and it's pretty compelling.
Okay, if you do it real quick, we have 15 seconds.
All right. The equitable tolling principles are to be read into every federal statute of limitations unless Congress expressly provides to the contrary in clear and unambiguous language. Since TILA does not evidence a contrary congressional intent, its statute of limitations must be read to be subject to equitable.
Thanks for listening to our broadcast. We hope that you tell your friends about us and let them know that there is hope and help in this financial crisis. Tune in every week to The Neil Garfield Show for free information and advice, and visit our blog daily at The Living Lies Blog. We provide support services, the latest strategies, analysis, expert consultations, testimony, and declarations to use in your battle against the largest economic crime in human history. For information concerning Neil, the team at Living Lies, or the law firm, go to www.livinglies.wordpress.com or call 520-405-1688. The opinions expressed on this broadcast are those of the host and should not be attributed to any other person or entity.